Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, it's Orca Awareness Month in Washington State. Things we should be aware of include our history of fear of the so-called killer whales. That morphed into a better recognition of their complex intelligence, concurrent with profitable schemes to imprison them in water parks. Now, our awareness must include the threat of their extinction. In 1984, there were 74 Puget Sound-based southern resident orcas. Their number grew to 98 by 1995, but has fallen steadily since then to 75 currently. The Center for Whale Research announced last week the death of a 23-year-old male, L92, nicknamed Cruiser. Jason Colby is an associate professor of environmental and international history at the University of Victoria. His new book is Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. It chronicles the history of human fascination with orcas and the prospects for their survival. Colby has a personal link to that history in the Northwest. His father helped capture and sell orcas. Jason Colby spoke at University Lutheran Church on June 5th. Town Hall Seattle presented his talk, recorded by KUOW's Sonia Harris. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
My name is Edward Wolcher. I'm the curator of lectures at Town Hall Seattle, and I am so honored to welcome you to tonight's program with Jason Colby, presented by Town Hall in partnership with our friends at the Elliott Bay Book Company, who are set up in the lobby over there. Now to introduce our program and to give us some more context about orcas in our state is Dr. Thomas Peirce, who goes by Les. He is the governor-appointed co-chair of the governor's Orca Recovery Task Force, having previously served for 15 years as the president of the Evergreen State College, one of my favorite institutions in Washington State. Go Gooey Ducks. Please welcome Dr. Peirce to the stage.
Thank you, Ed. Good evening, everyone. It's so nice to be with you. 55 years ago, I came to the state of Washington from the high plains deserts of the state of Idaho. I'm a third generation Idahoan from Pocatello. And in 1972, I was a staff member at Washington State University, a young fellow who had never been to the Salish Sea or the Puget Sound when I first came over to the wet side, as we would refer to it in those days. And I'll never forget a friend of mine who had a boat at Stanley Park invited me to spend 10 days with him and his family on the coast. And it was during that period that I first saw the orcas, and I have never forgotten the impact, the marvel, the marvelous power, and the way they plied the water. I remember going home and talking to my friends and family in the sagebrush about those wonderful animals. And I think now that in 1972, 40 years before that, the southern resident killer whales numbered almost 200. And by 95, they were under 100. All the actions now that are taken when these fine animals are down to 76 speaks to the important concern that the governor had when he established the Orca Task Force to look at how we could begin to take action at the major challenges that face these wonderful animals. food, the toxin in the Salish Sea and the Puget Sound, and noise, population and vessels, and the reality that the Chinook salmon are the primary source of food for these wonderful animals, and how we go about attempting to reverse this huge challenge and threat to these wonderful creatures. The reality is that our destiny is connected with these wonderful creatures. The health of our sound, our economy, are all associated and intertwined. And as we see the challenges they have, having difficulty finding food, trying to survive in toxic water, and being unable to find their prey because of the increased noise, tells us that we have to begin to try to take steps to really address this challenge, because it is a challenge for us as well. My co-chair, Stephanie Celine, is here with me. Stephanie, would you please stand up? I want people to, and we have established over 50 individuals in the state who have broken into work groups to look at issues of toxins in the sound, noise, and the issue of the Chinook, and the issue of food and all that comes with those challenges. And when Town Hall announced this wonderful event with Jason, we thought, what a wonderful time to introduce our work. The governor has asked us to have a report by the end of October, so that in November he can receive the final report and have it ready for the legislature for action. So many of the people that are involved in this effort say, for so long we've kicked the can down the road. We recognize that this is a very challenging issue. It raises issues about our dams. It raises issues around how we balance our commerce and our recreation with the lives of these animals. It raises the issue of what are the manner in which we can bring the endangered Chinook back to health. Hatcheries, wild salmon, and all of these groups, the three work groups, are working in each of these issues with scientists, and we've brought together a diverse group of people from commerce, citizens, from public agencies, the tribes. All have sat down at the table and agreed to try as hard as they can to come up with recommendations. We know that some will be controversial. We know that we're going to have to face and find a way to open dialogue among all of us to be able to come up with recommendations that really are recommendations about our future, I believe. So I go back and I think about this. I think about 55 years ago, and I find myself a cowboy from southern Idaho in this role, and I think, what a special opportunity as an outdoorsman, as a person that understands that my two grandkids ought to have the opportunity that I had 55 years ago to see such magnificent creatures. And so we really have a cheap treat this evening, because Dr. Colby has written an extraordinary book, and we have the opportunity this evening to have him share his insight as a historian. As a person that I know from my conversations this evening with him, is someone that has a long-term perspective in regard to the orca and how we viewed them in the past, the actions we took or the actions we didn't take. He is a professor at the University of Victoria. He was born in Victoria, British Columbia, raised in the Seattle area. He worked as a commercial fisherman in Alaska and in Washington State. He's the author of The Business of Empire, United Fruit, Race, U.S. Expansion in Central America, and the book that we have the opportunity to acquire tonight, Orca, How We Come to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. That is the subject of his talk this evening. Everyone, please join me in welcoming Jason.
Wow, what a great crowd. I want to just start by saying what an honor it is to be a part of this series, Town Hall Seattle, even if it is homeless at the moment, is an extraordinary part of the city's intellectual life, its political life. It's really an amazing opportunity for me to speak as part of this series. It's also a wonderful opportunity to speak during Orca Awareness Month, which is recognized by my home state of Washington, my adopted state of, or my adopted province of BC, our neighbors to the south in Oregon. Not always by our federal governments on both sides of the border, but certainly by us here in the Northwest. So my new book delves into issues that are politically charged today. Captivity, the history of captivity, environmental damage, the survival of the southern resident killer whales, certainly the recent campaign launched by the Lummi Nation to bring about the return of Lolita from the Miami Seaquarium, where she's been for the last 48 years. But I want to say that I also had very personal reasons for writing this book. In the 1970s, my father helped capture orcas on both sides of the border. And during my childhood, growing up here in Puget Sound, he wrestled with the meaning and the pain and some of the guilt that came with that past, particularly as killer whales became increasingly iconic in the Pacific Northwest. And that was, of course, before the documentary Blackfish drew the attention of millions, not just here, but around the world, to the question of captivity for orcas. Today, as Dr. Peirce just noted quite eloquently, the orca is a central part of our region's, not just ecosystem, but identity, culture, certainly tourist industry. And the southern residents, those 76 endangered in the population, they're the most studied population of cetaceans, dolphins, porpoises, and whales, most studied in history. They have, as I'll make the argument here a little bit today and as I make in the book, they've been also the most influential in our environmental politics, not just here in the Northwest, but internationally. And they are definitely, make no mistake about it, on their way to extinction, unless creative and fierce action is taken. So I set out in this book to make sense of how we got here. How did we go from fearing and shooting and slaughtering to loving this apex predator so quickly, from really the early 60s to the early 80s? What does it say about them? What does it say about us that change happened here, happened so quickly? And in the present, certainly, what is our moral obligation to them? What is our moral obligation to the southern resident orcas, who helped, I would argue, change us for the better? Well, the key to this process, as I'm going to lay out a little bit in this talk, was the fact that we came to see them not as interchangeable specimens, as indistinguishable black and white masses flowing through the water, but as individuals with their own connections, their own families, their own potential relations with us. And the key to this, jarring, counterintuitive even as it might seem, historically the key to this was in fact captivity itself, which transformed popular and scientific views of the species from the fearsome killer to the lovable orca. Now, for centuries, the impression was of that terrifying killer whale. And it was the maritime industries all around the world, but certainly, you know, we're most familiar with those off of Northern Europe and then North America. The maritime industries of whaling, fishing, sealing. It was the men that worked in these industries that really shaped popular and early naturalists, early scientists' visions of this species. And it was a fearsome picture. Ursinus orca, they called it. Now, most of us don't know our Latin anymore, but Ursinus orca can be translated as demon from the netherworld. The men who worked on the seas thought about them that way, and they used those terms actually interchangeably. We think about the term orca as being friendly and cozy now, but in fact, it's not a new term. Throughout the 19th century, writers, whalers used killer and orca very commonly, and both conjured a predator that didn't just compete for valued resources, literally stealing away harpooned whales sometimes, snatching away seals, hunting the salmon that fishermen chased, but in their eyes, potentially attacked and ate people. Writing in the 1870s, whaling captain Charles Scammon, who was himself famous for slaughtering gray whales in the waters of Mexico, called orcas, quote, marine beasts who spread, quote, terror and death to every ocean. Decades later, the director of the Bronx Zoo declared, quote, the killer whale, or orca, is the demon of the seas. On the Pacific coast, indigenous whaling people, such as the Macaw of what is now Cape Flattery and the Nuchalnuth of Western Vancouver Island, sometimes hunted orcas. They found it very difficult catching them, and in fact, one theory is that they sent off troublesome teenage boys to chase them and just say, go catch the blackfish. Burn off some energy. Testosterone, as one orca scientist told me, is a poison. But commercial whalers generally on the West Coast ignored killer whales. And this was true after World War II as well. In contrast to Japanese and Norwegian whalers in the post-war period, who killed thousands of orcas in those decades, I actually only found one case in the post-war period of commercial whalers in the Northwest taking one. It was actually the Coal Harbor Whaling Station on Vancouver Island that killed this orca, as one of the residents of that town told me when he was present, on the request, a contract request from the Disney company, which wanted to stuff and display the whale in California. But even if they weren't hunting them in these years on the West Coast, the perception in North America, certainly, of killer whales as pests and potentially man-eating ones at that only grew in those years. And you see lots of different images, but I'm going to show you my all-time favorite. So Stag Magazine, December 1953. I had to assure my mom that this is not the kind of stacks that I usually dive into in my research, but you'll notice that most of the men probably bought it for that top story, sexual practices of American women. But it shows an angry, enraged killer whale spilling these two men on this raft, two burly, strapping men into the sea. This is the vision we have here. And I'm going to go out on a limb. I don't have confirmation on this, but I'm going to go out on a limb that a lot of men in the Navy saw this picture, reading Stag. And months after this issue ran, a NATO base with U.S. Navy men in Iceland, at the request of the Icelandic government, carried out an expedition against the orcas in the North Atlantic, strafing them in several different campaigns. And this is a campaign celebrated in Time magazine at the time. This is 1954. And by the accounts of journalists, killing between 100 and 200 killer whales in those forays. Those actions were hardly surprising in the context of the time. The Navy diving manual, up until the mid-1960s, described killer whales as, quote, ruthless and ferocious, instructing divers to get out of the water if any appeared. As one famed diving writer wrote in his diving guidebook, quote, "There is no treatment for being eaten by the orca except reincarnation." It was a quirk of geography that made this place, the Pacific Northwest, the crucible of change. The region's population centers in the 20th century sat on Puget Sound, the Strait of Georgia, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, a trans-border marine ecosystem we now call the Salish Sea. And this was also a large portion of the main range of what scientists would later label the southern resident killer whales, three pods, we now call them J, K, and L, which rely almost exclusively, well, primarily on Chinook salmon. As late as 1880, they may have numbered as high as 250 individuals. But industrial fishing came to the region then. Industrial fish traps the size of football fields. Commercial fishing fleets that brought falling Chinook runs as well as growing human violence toward killer whales that were seen as competitors. Also critical in the 1930s and 40s in particular beginning was the remaking of the Sacramento and the Columbia rivers. Dams destroyed salmon runs and other factors as well. By the 1940s, Hanford was dumping nuclear waste, immense amounts of nuclear waste, into the Columbia River, which the U.S. government declared in 1966, quote, the most radioactive river in the world. All this change likely drove the southern residents to spend more time foraging in the Salish Sea, where fishermen, growing numbers of commercial and increasingly sports fishermen as well, regarded them as threats to salmon, potentially threats to themselves, and frequently shot them. For their part, scientists based in the region, and particularly scientists based in Seattle's Marine Mammal Biological Laboratory, the modern version of it now is NOAA's National Marine Mammal Laboratory, had a very different mandate at the time. The lab then, this is the one that sits on Lake Washington, on Sand Point, Magnuson Park, it viewed, the scientists there viewed orcas as a threat to resources, commercial resources used by the American government and commercial enterprises. The lab in particular managed the northern fur seal harvest in Alaska. And this was the main interest they had in killer whales. How many northern fur seals did killer whales eat off the Pacific coast? Through the 1960s, researchers based there regularly harpooned orcas in cooperation with the whalers of California to study their stomach contents to determine if they were eating northern fur seals. 1961, the Seattle Times celebrated one such kill in which the lab's esteemed scientist, Bellevue resident Victor Sheffer, described orcas as bloodthirsty. And this opportunistic killing of orcas continued through the 1960s, well, until 1967. This is one killed off Morro Bay. This is a large male. And this is a researcher who was working in Seattle at the time. Things went further in British Columbia, where officials, at the behest of fishing lodges, mounted a 50-caliber machine gun just north of Campbell River on Seymour Narrows to essentially protect the sport fishing industry by killing orcas that passed by. Now, they never fired it at killer whales because in a moment of clarity, they realized that bursts of 50-caliber machine gun fire might also chase off the tourists and the sport fishermen. Now, it's at this moment, the early to mid-1960s, at the height of this violence, globally and certainly regionally, that a change came, and it came from live capture. And it all began by accident, in fact, by a capture that was intended not to be a live capture. In the summer of 1964, the Vancouver Aquarium attempted to kill a young killer whale to use as a model for a sculpture in its foyer. Set up on East Point on Saturna Island, harpooned the whale with a harpoon that should have killed him, the young calf, but miraculously, it didn't. When this youngster didn't die, they led it to Vancouver. And there, the whale, they were very confused about the sexing of killer whales then. And so they named the whale Moby Doll, believing that, that the only explanation for it being somewhat friendly toward people was that it was female. All kinds of talk about the feminine temper of Moby Doll and such. And for 2 months, the aquarium held it there. It was only displayed for a day. It doesn't make a massive impact on popular perceptions, but scientists were able to interact with the whale. Nobody got in the water with it, but eventually started hand-feeding Moby Doll. When he eventually died, about 2 months after capture, it was revealed that, as one newspaper reporter, because remember, some pretty adolescent humor in the 1960s, declared Moby Doll was in fact Moby Dick. Now the key transformative change came right here in Seattle, on the Seattle waterfront. The Seattle Marine Aquarium, which no longer exists, but was owned by an entrepreneur named Ted Griffin, started in 1962, built in 1962 during the Seattle World's Fair. And Griffin had displayed lots of sea life, including seals, sea lions, but he had this dream, this obsessive dream to befriend an orca. And he searched for ways to capture one. And all throughout Puget Sound, but failed. And in the summer of 1965, fishermen off the little town of Namu, BC, northern BC, accidentally caught a large male orca. Griffin went around to all the waterfront merchants, including Ivor's acres of clams, asked for cash to buy this whale, flew up to Namu, BC, bought the whale with a duffel bag full of cash, and built a makeshift floating pen to transport the whale, now named Namu, 450 miles south to Seattle. And this captured headlines, not just in Seattle, but around the world, and captured massive public attention when it approached Puget Sound. This is a crowd of thousands on the Deception Pass Bridge. I'm going to tell you right now, the 1960s had very different ideas of child safety than, I mean, I've been to that bridge, and I wouldn't be carrying my kids on my shoulders. This is a shot of Namu's arrival on the pier, Pier 56, where the acting mayor and the lieutenant governor both greeted Namu and Griffin, presented Griffin with a key to the city. This was considered a great attraction for the Seattle waterfront. Now, no one believed Griffin's promises that he would actually get into the water with this monster. No one that anyone knew of in history had ever swam with a killer whale. But he told people repeatedly he was going to, and then one day on the Seattle waterfront, he slipped in. And this became a shocking scene to people. Griffin and his whale swimming, and Griffin emerging from the water repeatedly without being eaten. The two eventually performed the very first shows, killer whale shows, off Pier 56. Millions would read about this relationship, this bond, in a still famous among orca lovers 1966 National Geographic article. Lots of the scientists I interviewed for this book cited that article as the beginning of their love affair with killer whales. And many more would see Namu and Griffin, actually footage of them in the fictionalized version of Namu's life. Oops, I should have shown you this. This is Namu. This is a shot that I opened with Namu performing at Pier 56 with the Coleman Ferry Dock in the background. Namu the movie comes out in the summer of 1966, same producer as the television and movie Flipper. This is shot in Rich Cove, right close to Port Orchard, it's right across the way here. By that time, Namu had died of pollution in Elliott Bay, a bacterial infection. But his impact in that year was twofold. First, the public marveled at his gentleness that seemed to just belie the reputation of this species, his gentleness with Griffin. And second, more momentously, his popularity convinced oceanariums around the world to acquire their own orcas. And in the following year, Griffin and his new company, Namu Incorporated, started supplying them with whales captured almost entirely in Puget Sound, including SeaWorld's first killer whale. SeaWorld bought a young female killer whale caught in Puget Sound, wanted to name that whale Namu. Griffin refused. That was a copyrighted name, and so they decided they would name her She Namu, or Shamu, which became, of course, the Mickey Mouse of SeaWorld, right? Captive orcas drew crowds to these oceanariums, giving most visitors their first close view of cetaceans. And for many visitors, their first sense of whales, orcas, but of whales, as individuals with personalities. By 1970, some 30 million people had seen captive killer whales. And those people weren't just spectators. Many of them were scientists. And I can't overstate this enough. Scientists with the first, historically, the first access to study live killer whales. Prior to this, it was shoot and dissect. They not only studied their physiology, their diving mechanisms, their acoustic capacity. This is when there was confirmation that killer whales used echolocation, used biosonar. But they also came to know them as individuals with personalities, and that had a profound impact on scientists as well. One of those individuals I want to mention who was captured just across the way in Yukon Harbor, just across you know, from Elliott Bay. One of those individuals was named Scanna. Caught in in February of 67 and bought by the Vancouver Aquarium in a month later, so March of 67, Scanna didn't just draw visitors to Stanley Park, she captivated a young researcher named Paul Spong. Spong was from New Zealand, who's a traditionally trained, studying the anatomy of the human brain. Got this job at the Vancouver Aquarium, initially to study dolphins, but also to study this new killer whale. And he at first tried a very simple test to assess her visual acuity, to figure out how well do killer whales see out of the water. And it's a really simple test of distinguishing between a card with one line and two lines, and they shifted the cards the distance between the lines. Scanna took a while to pick it up, but eventually she did. And she started answering almost perfectly, day after day after day, until one day it changed. Scanna started answering wrong. Not just wrong sometimes, 100% wrong. How do you explain that as a scientist? The scientist who's seen animals mechanistically. Paul Spong couldn't figure it out. There's obviously an element of agency here on this animal's part. Scanna's deciding, I'm not going to do your test anymore. I don't like your test. I'm bored. One day, Spong, I'm hoping not to pop my microphone off here, one day Spong took off his shoes and his socks and he was dangling his bare feet in the pool. Scanna was doing laps. And he was pondering this creature. What's making her tick? Why is she doing this? What's the problem? She's swimming around. She swims closer and closer. And all of a sudden, she opens her mouth and rakes his bare feet with her wolf-like teeth. I'm wearing a microphone, so I won't scream like he has reported he did. But he screamed, pulls his feet up. She circles around again. He gets up the courage to put his feet back in. She didn't really hurt me. And she does it again. 11 times they do this dance. 11 times he pulled his feet out. On the 12th, he found the courage to keep his feet in. And after that 12th pass, she didn't get a reaction. She stopped. And Paul Spong, the researcher, realized he was the subject of an experiment. This was mind-blowing to him. It doesn't just transform his idea of Scanna, but his relationship with animals, with research. And ultimately, it politicizes him. It brings a break with the aquarium. He goes off on his own, becomes a pioneer in wild killer whale research, as well as, I'll come back to in a moment, a key figure in the anti-whaling campaign. But meanwhile, while all that's happening, the captures are ramping up in Puget Sound, and they culminate in an event that is still remembered by those who were alive then, as a pretty infamous moment in this history. And that's in August 1970, when Griffin's company, Namu Incorporated, unknowingly, I should emphasize, captured all three pods of southern resident orcas in Pen Cove off Whidbey Island. It's important to note that there was no regulation at the time for orca capture. All of them could have been at that moment removed and sold to oceanariums with raging demand all over the world. For the orcas there, as well as the human witnesses, the event was traumatic, and the people that lived through it still talk about it. Griffin, when he realized what had happened, that they had too many animals to handle, immediately ordered half of the whales released. But activists that night, angry at what they were witnessing, tried to cut the rest of the whales free. Pen coves got vicious tides. And when the nets were loose from their anchors, they collapsed. The older whales were able to avoid them. The youngest calves were not. Three young calves drowned. Griffin and his partner, Don Goldsberry, opted to conceal the deaths, sink the bodies, kept several of the whales for sale before releasing the rest. Among those young whales kept was a young female who would go to Miami Seaquarium and become known as Lolita. She's still there. When the deaths were discovered, the bodies were discovered, the public backlash was severe and contributed to a push first at the state level in Olympia and then at the federal level to protect orcas and marine mammals. 1971, Washington State passed regulation on orca capture, didn't ban it, but started regulating it through the Game Department. And the next year, the U.S. Congress passed the Marine Mammal Protection Act, a sweeping, extraordinary piece of legislation that doesn't have an equivalent in Canada. While that was going on, the Save the Whales movement was emerging, and it had ongoing ties to orca captivity, ones that are often forgotten now. In 1973, after meeting the writer Farley Mowat in Vancouver, Paul Spong decided he had to do something against commercial whaling. And he lobbied Vancouver's new organization, Greenpeace, to look into the issue. Greenpeace, most forget, had been founded as an anti-nuclear organization, had no interest in whaling. But he lobbied the organization's leader, Bob Hunter, and invited Hunter to come to the Vancouver Aquarium to visit Scana with him. And Hunter did. There's a press conference there. Spong's about to launch a private diplomatic mission, essentially, to Japan to convince Japanese whalers to stop. And he brings Hunter down where Scana, who hasn't seen Spong in a couple of years, this is in 1974, greets Spong and then meets Hunter, who's very nervous. This is a giant animal with pointy teeth, remember. And eventually Hunter comes up with the courage to lean down, and Scana rubs against him. And eventually gently shoots out of her water, out of the water, and lightly grasps his head in her mouth and holds it there and then releases it. Now, this moment in Hunter's memoirs and documentaries on Greenpeace is seen as a transformative moment for Hunter, and it is. I mean, he writes about it as just a mind-blowing moment. And it often goes down in Greenpeace lore as an encounter of Hunter with wild nature. It's easy to forget that the moment was only possible because of the captivity. I mean, and in fact, the behavior itself, grasping his head, was a trained behavior. Obviously, that's not going to happen in the wild. Hunter goes on to launch a crusade, or to help lead with Spong, a crusade against commercial whaling over the next few years. In June 1975, the organization manages to find Soviet whalers off the coast of California and get a few seconds of footage that then becomes what they were looking for, the mind bomb to explode in people's heads and show them how horrific whaling was. One of the reasons, I mean, people had seen footage of whaling, you know, in the 40s and the 50s and 60s. What made this different was, first of all, you had footage of activists trying to stop it. But you also had people for the first time seeing this footage, you know, on Walter Cronkite's broadcast, thinking about whales, in this case sperm whales, as individuals who are getting killed, as families who are getting killed. It's a different optic. Meanwhile, back here, well, back in this region, in BC, a researcher named Michael Bigg was making a breakthrough. And many of you, if you're familiar with killer whale science, must be familiar with this name, Michael Bigg. He was making a breakthrough that would take that change, thinking about killer whales as individuals, to a new level, and really cetaceans as individuals. Working partly with captive animals, this is a shot of him with Haida and Sealand in 1973, trying out a radio telemetry device that he would then use on a released whale. Working partly with captive orcas, he developed a system for identifying individual animals by their dorsal fins, the cuts and the nicks on their dorsal fins, as well as their distinctive saddle patches. Other scientists, especially based in the U.S., were resistant to this idea. What do you mean you can identify individual whales? What, by taking a picture in the water? And they argued the only way to identify and track individual animals was to catch them and to mark them. And they tried many ways to do this in Puget Sound: dry ice branding, laser marking. But Big System ultimately won out. It's accepted in time, and it becomes the way that ever since we have been able to identify individuals and then understand matrilineal structures, pods. It's the reason we know so much about them now. And that was critical to understanding that these are indeed families with these tight-knit social structures. And that had already become central to public views by 1975 and 76. 76, when SeaWorld comes to Puget Sound and conducts what I can only call an ill-advised capture in Puget Sound. Now, if I were pitching this as a novel, my editor would say, you know, this part, SeaWorld's capture, it's not very plausible. It's stretching plausibility. No one's going to believe this. Luckily, this actually happened, so I didn't need to invent this. It occurred within sight of the state capital of Olympia, where legislators literally days before had been discussing the possibility of making Puget Sound a whale sanctuary. And not just that, but it occurred just days before the first orca symposium in history was about to be held at Dr. Peirce's former school, Evergreen, right? Which, as we all know, is right next to Olympia. And one of the top aides to Governor Dan Evans was actually out on the water with friends when this happened and tried to stop the capture. You can't make this stuff up. I didn't have to. The public, as well as these state officials who see it, are outraged, and protesters immediately besiege the capture site. The state government, led by, initially led by Ralph Monroe, this aide, but ultimately approved by Dan Evans, Attorney General Slade Gordon, sue SeaWorld and the federal government over this capture, and eventually, to great applause in Puget Sound, bring about the end of captures in the state. Such was the affection that orcas had generated in the region, and I think it's little wonder then that the next year, 1977, when Paramount tried to capitalize on Jaws, the Jaws phenomenon, by releasing a movie with the director called an even bigger, badder monster, it didn't do well in the Northwest. Orca, killer whale, who bites off the leg of, I'm forgetting the actress's name now. Absent-minded professor, apologies. I will say this about this movie, if any of you are thinking of running out and seeing if you can find this, this is an hour and 32 minutes of your life. You'll never get back. So, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. But that change, I mean, that made this such a laughable movie in the Northwest, you know, this is not what orcas are. That change hadn't come everywhere, as the events of the next few years made clear. In 1980, the Soviet Union shocked many when it reported that it had killed 916 killer whales in that year's Antarctic hunt. 916. And of the females examined on their decks, 141 of them were pregnant. For researchers in the Pacific Northwest who had painstakingly identified individual whales and their family structures, this carnage was unimaginable. The next year, Michael Bigg and other experts from the region traveled to Europe and convinced the International Whaling Commission to stop the harvesting of orcas. And it was, of course, the next year when the commission, lobbied forcefully by Greenpeace and other organizations, passed a whaling moratorium. By then, orcas were becoming icons in the Northwest. Whale-watching companies began to appear in the 1980s, and especially the 90s. And officials who had once targeted orcas were now charged with protecting them. No one typified this shift more than that Bellevue resident I mentioned before, Victor Sheffer. He had spent his career supervising the killing of animals for commercial industries, especially the killing of northern fur seals. Like other researchers, he had thought about orcas as pests, as specimens to be studied through dissection. It was he who had described them as bloodthirsty in 61 in the Seattle Times. But Sheffer, too, had lived this change. He had been president of the Marine Mammal Commission in the late 70s, started to see marine mammals, killer whales, differently. And how did he explain this? Well, in the Seattle Times in 1994, he said, quote, "Seeing them in aquariums individualized these creatures. They were no longer just whales in the abstract." This is one of my favorite shots of this era I've been speaking of. This is right off of Manchester. This is JPOD. Some researchers believe they've identified Granny, the oldest southern resident who recently passed away, in this photo. When Sheffer was interviewed in the mid-90s, the southern resident killer whales seemed to be enjoying a recovery after the end of live capture, nearing 100 individuals by the late 1990s. But that trend has not continued. In the past two decades, as the human population of the Salish Sea has spiked, the southern residents have dwindled. We now have more than 100,000 people in the Salish Sea for every one resident orca. Today they number just 76. I should emphasize, we hope. We haven't had a great count yet this summer. And although we enjoy them on both sides of the border, they rely primarily, partly because of the damage to the Sacramento River, the Columbia River, the Chinook runs in Puget Sound, they rely predominantly on the Fraser River in the Vancouver area for their critical Chinook runs. And those Chinooks are vanishing. And the Canadian government's decision to take over and guarantee the expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline recently can only threaten their access to this last food source, last reliable food source. And with it, threaten this population of orcas, who I can't emphasize enough, taught us to love their species and helped us rethink our own priorities. So I want to actually leave us with just a few questions rather than conclusions. I think we have to ask ourselves on both sides of the border, what do we owe them? What do we owe them for what they've given to us? What is our moral debt, in other words, to the southern resident killer whales? And amidst debates over fishing regulation, pollution, acoustic pollution, the repatriation the return of Lolita from the Miami Seaquarium, I think we should also ask us how the history I just laid out in a sketch, and certainly do in much more detail in my book, how does this history help us not just understand how we've changed, but help us find a path to healing and redemption and understanding and forgiveness?
Jason Colby, thank you so much for that. I'd like to invite Les Peirce and Stephanie Soline, co-chairs of the Governor's Orca Recovery Task Force, onto stage for Q&A. There's a microphone the two of you can share, and you're welcome to sit down there. And folks who have questions, now is the time. Who's brave enough to kick it off? Or if maybe there's any, before we have a first question, if either of you would like to respond, Stephanie or Les, to anything you heard.
Well, thank you, Jason. Your book, I think, is both a powerful history of where the orca have been in our world and also in our region and how we have viewed them. And I guess what gives me hope is that we can learn from our mistakes, and we have an opportunity now to come together and make a very heavy lift, but a lift that I think is possible if we all come together to try to save these animals, but really, in saving the orca and the Chinook salmon that they depend, we're really going to be saving, as Les said, ourselves and our quality of life that is so important to who we are. I want to acknowledge the First Peoples, the tribes both in Washington, but the First Nations in Canada, who have been critical partners in the work that we're doing both on the orca, but have worked for decades on recovering the salmon. And we have an opportunity in working with the tribes, learning about the traditions and how to take care of this earth in a way that they are doing now, but also wanting to share with us. And look at the way we develop, look at the way we are treating this land and this water that we call home. So, Jason, your book is a very powerful testimonial to our past, but also to, I think, a future that we can make if we all come together, and that's what the task force is going to attempt, and we can't do it without your help, so we really appreciate everyone being here tonight.
I would only add that I think in the time that Stephanie and I have had discussions and met people around the state who are involved in this effort, you really have to appreciate the fact that there are a number of people in this state that have been committed to the health of our sound and the wildlife that have provided an effort that has made a difference in such a way that has prevented things from getting worse. And they have to be acknowledged, all these organizations that have been committed to and concerned. The point now is that more and more of our citizens have to understand what's at stake. That's why this is so powerful this evening. And to do as they did in the 70s, when they realize that we have animals that are a part of us that provide so much to our environment. And we're hoping that more and more people will come and enter into this discussion.
Any questions from the audience? If you don't mind coming down, using the microphone.
Hi, thanks for the interesting talk and the history, giving out the history. I was wondering what's being done. I know the noise pollution damages the echolocation system, and I was wondering what recently is the current thoughts are on how to resolve the problem. The noise from boats.
As Les said, in his remarks, the task force is looking at the three threats that are facing the orca, and one is noise underwater from boats and ships. And we have a working group made up of the whale watching community, the recreational boating community, the maritime community. We're working as well with our neighbors in Canada. There's been a lot of research that has been done and more that is needed, but we know that both the whale watching and recreational boaters that follow the southern residents when they are in convenient locations, that noise, as well as the ship traffic out in the deeper water, they create different types of noise, but both sounds interfere with the orca's ability to echolocate. What we've learned is that they need to echolocate to find the Chinook. And while we don't have a lot of fish out there, if we can lower the volume around them and lower the stress level from boats that get too close, if we can figure out how to slow down the larger ships to lessen the noise that they make, it allows them to find the prey that exists. And so one of the things that the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has just announced, and the whale watching community, the commercial whale watching community is also supporting, is a no-go zone off the west coast of San Juan Island, where the whales have been coming. They haven't been coming lately. We're actually not seeing the southern residents in the Salish Sea like we used to. I reside on Orcas Island. And so that was a big part of everybody's summers, was enjoying those whales. So we're, the no-go zone is an attempt to give them some quiet space. There's also other feeding areas and socialization areas that are being looked at to try to create, again, voluntary no-go zones. I should say that it is voluntary. But they're really getting the word out, so we hope that will help.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Jason Colby is the author of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. He spoke at University Lutheran Church on June 5th. Town Hall Seattle presented his talk. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Catch up with other great Seattle talks by subscribing to our podcast. We appreciate your likes and comments. Tune in again soon.